Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast, which has been transformed over the holiday season into a cabinet of curiosities and delights from more than a century of short fiction. In this edition, Jonathan Safran Foer introduces the most recent story in our series by a modern master in the making, which is then read for you by Chris Moran.
Hi, this is Jonathan Safran Foer, and I'm here to talk about a short story by Alexander Heyman called The Bees Part One, which I read in The New Yorker when it came out 12 years ago, 15 years ago maybe. I was at the beginning of my own writing career, and I was vaguely aware of him because we shared an agent. We continue to share an agent. What I knew of him was that he came to America from Bosnia and found himself stranded here. Had no wasn't imagining he was going to immigrate, but he was here when the siege took place and ended up staying, learned English, and within a couple years of learning English started to write and write professionally. And this story, it's basically about a boy whose father becomes sort of obsessed with the idea of filming his life, the father filming his own life story, that is, with the son playing the father's role. And it's just absolutely beautifully written. It's very poignant, but it also felt, I felt exposed, as I do when I encounter stories that I love. I felt that it knew something about me that it shouldn't have, and by articulating it, it somehow exposed something about me. And in this case, it had to do with a few things. One was inheritance and heredity and the ways in which a son either corrects or amends or replays a father's mistakes. And the other is the idea of recreation. So the story, it takes up several pages, although it doesn't really go that many places, beyond the father's efforts to create something that is truthful, that's faithful to his own life experience. And so he's constantly correcting his son as they film these scenes, sometimes in ways that are almost always in ways that nobody else would ever care about. But his obsession with this faithful recreation just scratched at something, a kind of fetish inside of me. And that idea of faithful recreation has come up in, I think, everything I've ever written. Most recently, in my recent book, Here I Am, there's a chapter that take the form of instructions to actors who would be playing the roles of the author's family in a TV show. So this, the author, who's the hero of the book, has secretly written a TV show about his family, which he hasn't shared with anybody, but he imagines it one day being made, and at that point, the actors will follow these guidelines. And in a way, it's a direct lift from this Alexander Heyman story, the idea that we desperately want ourselves represented authentically, and that we want our stories not only retold, but retold truthfully. And it's amazing how often, when I tell somebody I'm a writer, as happened to me actually when I was in the cab on the way to the airport to London, cabbie said, "What do you do?" I said, "I'm a writer." And he said, "Oh, I've got a story for you. This thing happened in my life." And he started to tell it in really sort of exquisite detail. And it's not because he was unusual, it's because he's like everybody I've ever met, myself included, who, it's not that they want their lives justified or redeemed, but they want their lives expressed. And expressed faithfully, including the parts that are unattractive. And I've never encountered a work of art that better captures that feeling than Heyman's story.
The Bees, Part One, by Alexander Heyman. This is not real. Many years ago, back in Sarajevo, my sister and I went to see a movie with our parents. The film was about a handsome young man who goes on a treasure hunt, where he meets a beautiful young woman. Our mother fell asleep instantly. Motion pictures often had that effect on her. Our father had a different response. By the end of the first scene, he was snorting derisively. "This is stupid," he whispered in my ear. Then he turned to the people around us, imploring them conspiratorially, "Comrades, don't believe this. This is not real." The hero by this point was dangling upside down over a pit of ravenous crocodiles, and the audience did not respond warmly to my father's interruptions. My sister and I pretended to focus on the screen. An usher appeared and tried to silence him. Our mother, woken up by the ruckus, found herself in the middle of an embarrassing scene, which ended with our father storming out, dragging my sister and me with him as she apologized to the audience behind us. I took one last look back at the screen, where the hero and the disheveled yet fair damsel were riding a comical pair of mules through a jungle teeming with villains. My life. In the spring of 1979, Father came home with a Super 8 camera that he had borrowed from one of his co-workers, Bojo A, who had a black belt in karate and a budding brain tumour. He died before my father returned the camera. The camera was small, but it possessed a kind of technological seriousness, as if only important things could be recorded with it. Father announced that he was going to make a film that would not lie. My mother asked what the movie would be about. "The truth," he said. "Obviously." He had spent a week writing the script before he revealed that the movie would tell the story of his life. The filming was scheduled for the middle of June, when we would be in the country visiting his parents. We would shoot, as they say, on location. I was cast to play the young him, and my sister to play his sister. He didn't say which one, he had six. My mother was supposed to be his assistant director, but she resigned from her position almost instantly. She wanted to spend her vacation reading, she said. Father refused to show us the script and was entirely unmoved when we pointed out that actors normally get to rehearse. He wanted life itself to be our inspiration because, as he frequently reminded us, this film was to be real. Nevertheless, during our regular inspection of his desk, my sister and I found a copy, which we read to each other several times with a mixture of awe and hilarity. Here it is. My life. 1. I am born. 2. I walk. 3. I watch over cows. 4. I leave home to go to school. 5. I come back home. Everybody's happy. 6. I leave home to go to university. 7. I'm in class. I study at night. 8. I go out for a stroll. I see a pretty girl. 9. I go back home to see my parents with the pretty girl. 10. I marry the pretty girl. 11. I work. 12. I have a son. 13. I'm happy. 14. I keep bees. 15. I have a daughter. 16. I'm happy. 17. I work. 18. We are at the seaside. 19. We are happy. 20. My children kiss me. 21. I kiss them. 22. My wife kisses me. 23. I kiss her. 24. I work. 25. The end. Farewell. The first and only scene we shot was scene 4. The location was the slope of the hill below my grandparents' house. I, in the role of my father at age 14, was supposed to walk downhill, away from the camera, with a bundle hanging from a stick on my shoulder, whistling a plaintive melody, then turn and stare back past the camera to the home I was leaving, and wave, bidding it farewell. The first take failed because I didn't wave with enough emotion. My hand, my father said, looked like a limp, plucked chicken. The second take was interrupted when my father decided to zoom in on a bee that happened to land on a flower nearby. Two of my aunts suddenly appeared in the third take, just as my father was panning from my touching goodbye to the house. They stood, grinning, paralysed by the lens for a moment. Then they casually waved at the camera. Each time, I walked back uphill to my starting position. My legs hurt, I was hungry and thirsty, and I could not help questioning my father's directorial wisdom. Why wasn't he/I taking a bus? Didn't he/I need more stuff than could fit in a bundle? Didn't he/I need some food for the road? During the fourth take, the camera ran out of film. The fifth take was almost perfect. I walked away from home, my shoulders slouching with sorrow, my pace appropriately hesitant, the bundle dangling poignantly from the convincingly crooked stick. I turned and looked back at the house I was about to leave forever. It was white, with a red roof. The sun was setting behind it. Tears welled up in my eyes as I waved at the loving past, my hand like a metronome counting out the beats of the saddest adagio. Then I heard a bee. It was buzzing around the back of my neck. My metronome hand switched to allegro as I flicked it around my head, trying to defend myself. The bee would not go away. I dropped the stick and started running frantically, first uphill toward the camera, then downhill, my heels kicking at my butt. The bee pursued me relentlessly, and I was more terrified by its determination than I was by the thought of the inevitable sting. I hollered, threw my arms in the air, lunged ahead at breakneck speed, but the bee would not quit. And the more I ran, the further I was from any help. Then, just as I realized that the bee was actually caught in my hair, that my attempt to escape was futile, I tripped and tumbled. I felt the sting as I fell, rolling towards the foot of the hill where I was stopped by a thorn bush. Need I say that my father didn't stop filming? There I am, on screen, flapping my arms as if trying to take off, a clueless Icarus leaping ever farther from the sky while a cow watches with sublime indifference, as if to suggest that God and his innocent creatures will never give a flying fuck about the fall of man. Then I tumble and hit the bush of thorns, and my father, with his cold, directorial presence of mind, fades me out. Other works. To my father's artistic biography, I should add his woodworking proclivities. More than once, I witnessed him caressing or kissing the wood he was about to transform into a shelf, a stool, or a beehive frame. He often forced me to touch and smell a perfect piece of wood, to appreciate its smooth knotlessness, its natural scent. For my father, the world consisted of objects that you could hold in your hand. He built all kinds of things, toolboxes, beds, chairs, and structures to hold my mother's plants. But his masterpiece was a nailless kitchen table, which he spent a month putting together. He paid a price. One afternoon, he emerged from his workshop with his hands sliced open by a chisel, the blood gushing from the centre of his palm as if from a well, a detail worthy of a biblical miracle. He drove himself to the hospital, and the car afterward looked like a crime scene. He also liked to sing. One evening, I found him in front of the TV with a notebook and a sharpened pencil, waiting to transcribe the lyrics of his favourite song at the time, Drop, You Traitor Tear, which was about to be featured on a musical show. For days afterward, he sang Drop, You Traitor Tear over and over again, humming through the parts where he couldn't remember the lyrics, preparing for future performances. He sang at parties and family gatherings, and sometimes accompanied himself on a badly tuned guitar, playing the same three chords, A minor, C, D, 7, regardless of the song. He seemed to believe that even a severely mistuned guitar provided atmosphere, while the harmonic simplification would enhance the emotional impact of any song. And truly, it was hard to deny the power of his baritone against a background of discordant noise worthy of sonic youth, a tear glimmering in the corner of his eye as he contemplated its possible betrayal. His photography merits a mention too, even if its main intent was to record the merciless flow of time. The composition of almost all his photographs is identical. My mother, my sister, and I face the camera, the passing years measured by the emergence of my mother's wrinkles and grey hair, the width of my sister's beaming smile, and the thickness of my smirk. One more thing. He once bought a notebook and on the first page wrote, "This notebook is for expressing the deepest thoughts and feelings of the members of our family." Perhaps he intended to use those thoughts and feelings as material for a future book, but in the end, there were only two entries. A cryptic note from my mother, who had probably just grabbed the notebook while on the phone and wrote, Friday/healthy children/time the herb. And a line from my sister, in her careful and precise prepubescent handwriting, "I am really sad, because the summer is almost over." The real book. My father believed in whatever conveyed reality. He was suspicious of the television news, which relentlessly listed the triumphs of socialism, but he was addicted to the weather forecast. He read newspapers, but trusted only the obituaries. He loved nature shows, because the existence and the meaning of nature were self-evident. There was no denying a python swallowing a rat, or a cheetah leaping on the back of an exhausted, terrified gnu. But nothing insulted him more than literature. The whole concept was a scam. Not only was it all made from words, whose reality was precarious at best, but those words were used to render things that had never really happened. His dislike of literature may have been strengthened by my intense interest in it, for which he blamed my mother, and my consequent attempts to interest him. For his 45th birthday, I unwisely gave him a book called The Liars. He never got past the title. Once, I read my father a passage from a Garcia Marquez story in which an angel falls from the sky and gets locked up in a chicken coop, and he became seriously concerned about my mental capacities. In time, he began casually mentioning his plan to write a real book. Writing such a book would not be a particularly trying task, he suggested, provided one didn't get carried away with self-indulgent fantasies and stuck to what had really happened. All he needed was a few weeks off. But he could never find the time. There was his job, and the bees, and things to be built, and the necessary replenishing naps. One afternoon I found him snoring on the couch with his notebook on his chest and a pencil on the floor beside him, the only words written, "Many years ago." The Writer's Retreat. My father truly began writing in Canada in the winter of 1994. He and my mother and sister had settled there after a couple of years of refugee roaming, years that I'd spent working low-wage jobs in Chicago and pursuing a green card. They had left Sarajevo on May the 1st, 1992, the day before the siege began. There had been some shooting, and trouble was clearly brewing, but the main reason for their departure was my father's devotion to beekeeping. If he hadn't had to do the spring work in his apiary, clean up the hives, merge the weak hives with the strong and so on, they might not have left Sarajevo at all. In any case, they spent a year at his deceased parents' house in the country on a hill called Vučjak, living off the food they grew in the garden, watching as truckloads of Serbian soldiers passed by on their way to the front. My father occasionally sold honey to the troops, and toward the end of the summer he started selling mead too, although the soldiers preferred to get drunk on slivovitz. My parents secretly listened to radio broadcasts from the besieged Sarajevo, and they feared a knock on the door in the middle of the night. Then my mother got a gallbladder infection and nearly died. So they went to Novi Sad, where my sister was trying to complete her college degree. They applied for a Canadian immigration visa, got it, and arrived in Hamilton, Ontario, in December 1993. My father began to despair as soon as he set foot on Canadian soil. From the window of their 15th floor unfurnished apartment, he could see piles of snow, the smokestacks of the Hamilton steel mills, and a vacant parking lot. It was all black and white and grey, like the kind of bleak existentialist Eastern European movie my father, without exception, found both unreal and morbidly boring. He didn't know where he was, how they were going to pay for food and furniture. He didn't know what would happen if one of them got sick. And it was perfectly clear to him that he would never learn the English language. My mother, on the other hand, maintained her stoicism, partly to counterbalance my father's fears, and partly because she felt so defeated that nothing really mattered. She yielded herself to the tragic flow of things. I can still see her, patiently and unfalteringly twisting a Rubik's Cube while watching a television report about a Sarajevo massacre, completely unfazed by the fact that she wasn't and would never be anywhere close to solving the puzzle. She filled the apartment with the used furniture her English teacher had given her, but the place still looked hollow, devoid of all those crumbs of a lived life that had once led my parents home. the earth-shaped clock with Sputnik hands that my father had brought back from the USSR. The picture of me as a boy, sitting in a cherry tree, smiling, an instant before I fell and broke my arm. The bathroom pipe with a moisture stain that looked like an unshaved, long-haired Lenin. The badly framed reproduction of a Cézanne still life. The honey jars marked real honey, on whose labels little bees flew. My father dropped out of his English class, furious at a language that randomly distributed meaningless articles and insisted on having a subject in every stupid sentence. He made cold calls to Canadian companies and, in unintelligible English, described his life, which had included being an engineer who brought light to big cities, to perplexed receptionists who put him on indefinite hold. He nearly got sucked into a venture set up by a shady Ukrainian who convinced him that there was good money to be made by smuggling Ukrainian goose down into the country and selling it to the Canadian bedding industry. I'd call from Chicago, and my father would pick up the phone. "So what are you doing?" I'd ask. "Waiting," he'd say.
"For what?"
"Waiting to die." "Let me talk to Mum." And then one day, when his woe became so overwhelming that his soul literally hurt, like a stubbed toe or a swollen testicle, he began to write. He wouldn't show his writing to my mother or my sister, but they knew that he was writing about bees. In the early spring of 1994, I received a manila envelope on which was written, in a dramatic cursive, "The Bees, Part One." My hands trembled while I flipped through those 21 pages, as if I were unrolling a sacred scroll rediscovered after 1,000 years. My sense of sanctity was somewhat diminished by a sticky honey stain on page 6. The Bees, Part One. "There is something faithfully connecting our family and bees," is how my father's narrative begins. "Like a member of the family, the bees have always come back." Until his grandfather, my great-grandfather Theodore, first brought civilized beekeeping to Bosnia in 1912, my father writes, the natives had kept their bees in straw and mud hives and killed them with sulfur. Killed all of them to get the honey. He recounts the story of the few hives that travelled with his family from the hinterlands of Ukraine to the promised lands of Bosnia. The only thing promised them was plenty of wood, which enabled them to survive the winters. Those hives multiplied quickly, unimpeded by the First World War. Theodore's son, my grandfather, Ivan, who was 12 when he arrived in Bosnia, later became the first president of the beekeeping society in Prunjevo. In a photograph of the society's founding picnic, Ivan stands at the centre of a group of peasants with a fashionably long moustache and a dandyish cocked hat. Several of the other members proudly exhibit faces swollen with bee stings. "Sometimes there were interesting mischiefs with bees," my father notes, without conveying the actual mischiefs. Throughout the text, he wavers between ominous, weighty phrases establishing the historical context. "War was coming down that dirt road," or "the gods of destruction pointed their irate fingers at our honey jars," and highly technical descriptions of the revolutionary architecture of the hives his father built. He goes from a discussion of the horrible death a bee suffers when it stings, and the philosophical implications thereof, to a lyrical description of hawthorn in bloom and the piping of the queen bee, audible the night before the swarm leaves the hive. He devotes almost a page to the first time he recognized a queen bee. "A hive contains about 50,000 bees, and only one queen. She's noticeably bigger than the other bees, who dance around her, swirl and move in peculiar, even worshipful ways." Seeing that first queen bee, on a frame heavy with honey, he says, was like reaching the center of the universe. The vastness and the beauty of the world were revealed to him. The logic behind it all. The most successful period of our beekeeping, which began in the 20s with the founding of the Beekeeping Society, ended in 1942 during the Second World War, when we for the first time lost our bees, he writes. The loss was a major catastrophe for the family, but my father tries to maintain perspective. There were many tragedies in besieged Sarajevo then. There are worse things that can happen to you. A whole family, for example, can perish without a trace. We didn't perish, which is good. On the next page, he drew a map of the tiny village of Vučjak and the town of Prinjavo, 6 kilometers away. He placed little stars around the page to represent other villages and people in the area. It was a truly multinational place, he notes wistfully. Germans, Hungarians, Czechs, Poles, Ukrainians, Slovaks, Italians, Serbs, Muslims, Croats, and all the mixed ones. There were 17 different nationalities in all. Even a Japanese man who was a tailor in Prinjavo. In 1942, my father explains, lawlessness was rampant. There were roaming gangs of Serbs and of Croatian fascists and of Tito's partisans too. One day, 2 semi-soldiers showed up at the door of my father's house. They were his neighbours, ordinary peasants, except for their rickety rifles and their caps with the Chetnik insignia, an ugly eagle spreading its wings on the front, and the partisan red star on the back. They reversed the caps as they deemed necessary. There was going to be a great battle, the peasants said. They said we would be well advised to leave. They offered to padlock everything, and they showed us a huge key, for which it was clear no padlock existed. They suggested, touching the knives at their belts as if inadvertently, that we take only what we could carry. Father begged them to let us take a cow. My mother, my 6 sisters, and my 2 brothers wept. Winter was around the corner. Perhaps it was the weeping that made them take pity on us and let us take a cow, although it was the sick one. Her shrunken udder would not provide any milk or solace, and we left 30 beehives behind. In the next paragraph, my father's writing becomes unstable. A couple of sentences are crossed out. Beneath a shroud of fierce scratching, I can make out a few words and phrases. Raven, urine, belonging to, and skin, scythe. I was 6 years old, he continues, and I was carrying a meat grinder. His mother was carrying his youngest brother. He clung to her chest like a little monkey. Only after a few months did all the details of the pillaging and pilfering done by the neighbours come to light. After the peasants had emptied the house and the attic and the barn, they finally got to the bees. They wanted the honey, though there was little of it, just enough to help the bees survive the winter. They opened the hives and shook the helpless bees off the frames. It was late October. It was cold, and the bees couldn't fly or sting. They dropped to the ground in absolute silence. No buzz, no life. They all died that night. When the family finally returned home, my father found a mushy pile of rotting bees. Before they died, they had crawled closer together to keep warm. 2 of the hives had been stolen by another neighbour, Tedo, who was also a beekeeper. My grandfather, Ivan, knew that Tedo had them, but he had never asked for them. Tedo came by one day and, unable to look Ivan in the eye, claimed that he had just been taking care of the bees while the family was away. He offered to give them back. I remember going with my father to retrieve our bees. We went on a sleigh, and we had to be careful not to shake the 2 hives, lest the bees unfurl their winter clusters which kept them warm. My father sat between the hives, holding them steady. It was a cold night, with stars glittering like ice shards. If they were careful and patient, Ivan told him, these two hives would breed many more. The following year they had 6, and then twice as many, and in a few years they had 25. The conditions of production. Out of respect for my father's desire, his need, to produce a true book, I must append a few paragraphs on the conditions of his truth production. I wasn't there while he was writing it, so I have to use the accounts of a reliable witness, my mother. Thus, he wrote mainly in the afternoon, with a pencil, on filler paper in long, slanted engineer's cursive. He sat on his bed, with the bedside table between his legs. He sharpened his pencil with a Swiss Army pocket knife, a duty-free present from me years before, littering the bedroom floor with shavings. The pencils came from a 99-cent store, and their tips frequently broke. He snapped several of them, infuriated. Over the phone, I listened to elaborate laments and his retroactive appreciation of our pencils, pencils you could trust. Sometimes, he just sat there hissing at the pigeons on the balcony as they pecked at the breadcrumbs my mother left for them. He'd often interrupt his reflections to get himself a slice of bread with butter and honey. Eventually, he'd start writing, and he sometimes kept at it for as long as 45 minutes, an eternity for someone as impatient and miserable as my father. I'm holding his manuscript in my hand right now, and I can see the ebbs and flows of his concentration. I can decode the increase and decrease of his back pain in the smooth, steady handwriting, say, at the top of page 10, which then meanders on page 11. In the random words written in the margins, branco, horsemen, watermelon, slaughter. The adjectives accompanying lonely, arid nouns. Stinky wafting around feet. Classic alongside theft. Golden melting over honey. There are mid-sentence breaks with syntactical discrepancies that suggest his thoughts splintering. Sometimes a sentence simply ceases. We know. Then nothing. It must be said, but nobody knows what. On page 17, my father is in the middle of conveying a humorous story about another neighbour, a man named Branko. By this time, Ivan's hives had been confiscated by a socialist collective, and he had been put in charge of the co-op apiary, overseeing about 200 hives, far too many to keep productively in one place, but an order is an order. My father, 13 at the time, is helping him. The day is gorgeous. The birds are a-twitter. There is an apple tree in the centre of the apiary, its branches breaking with fruit. They work in complete silence, interrupted only by the occasional thud of a ripe apple falling to the ground. A swarm of bees is hanging from one of the branches, and they need to get it into a hive. Ivan suggests that he shake the branch, while my father holds the hive under it. When the swarm hits the hive, he says, it will just settle in, following the queen. But, my father anticipates, I might be too weak to hold the hive, and if the swarm misses it, the bees might fall on me. I know they don't sting when they're swarming, but if they fall with their stings down, they might still hurt me. What's more, we'd have to wait for them to gather again. Here comes Branko, clearly up to no good. He hates bees, because he's been stung many times, but he still offers to help, probably hoping to steal something. So Branko stands under the swarm instead of my father, looking fretfully up at the bees, trotting around in a small circle, trying to center the hive. As he is still moving, Ivan shakes the branch with a long, crooked stick, and the swarm falls directly onto Branko. Before a single sting breaks his skin, Branko is already screaming and shaking his head as if possessed by a host of demons. He bursts out of the apiary, crashes through a hedge, and throws himself into a mud puddle whose proprietress, an enormous sow, studies him lethargically. My father is rolling on the ground with laughter. A twitch that could be a smile surfaces on Ivan's face, then quickly vanishes. The paragraph breaks off. In the next paragraph, in a cursive so tense and weak it seems evanescent, my father writes about an epidemic that attacked the co-op's hives, spreading quickly because they were so close together and decimating the bee population. He describes the harrowing sight of a thick layer of dead bees glimmering in the grass. Ivan squats despondently, leaning on a tree, surrounded by rotting apples that beckon hysterical flies. "This is life," my father concludes. "Struggle after struggle, loss after loss, endless torment." Fathers and daughters. It took me some time to find out what had happened between the paragraphs. A month passed, at the beginning of which my father received a call from Nada, the daughter of his cousin Slavko, who had emigrated alone and ended up in Lincoln, Nebraska, where she went to college, majoring in library science and minoring in theology. Slavko and my father had grown up together, they were the same age, but Slavko had died recently, an accomplished alcoholic. Nada had called my father, she said, because her father had told her stories about their childhood together. My father was delighted to hear from her, said she could call any time because family is family. But phone calls were too expensive for both Nada and my father, so they started exchanging frequent letters. Instead of writing the bees, my father reminisced at length to Nada, fondly recalling his and Slavko's childhood mischiefs. His letters were rife with bees and apples and family get-togethers where everybody sang and hugged and licked honey from their fingertips. My mother told me that if Nada hadn't been a relative, she would have thought my father was in love. He had someone now for whom he could paint the picture of his life, to whom he could tell the true story. Nada's letters, however, were often rants, bemoaning the fact that her father had ended up a weak, bitter man, and her mother was overly receptive to the attentions of other men. She hated America and Americans, their provincialism, their stupid, rootless culture. She was clearly wretched, my mother said, but my father was, by and large, oblivious to that. Then Nada didn't write for a while. But one night my parents were woken up by an avalanche of paper slithering out of their fax machine. In a 65-page fax, Nada's father was upgraded to a child molester, her mother to a cheap prostitute. America had become a filthy inferno of idiocy and nothingness run by the Jews and the CIA. Her roommate, a Latina whore, was trying to kill her. Her professors discussed her with her classmates, showing secretly taken pictures of her naked body while frat boys masturbated. Her doctor had tried to rape her in the INS office, where she went to apply for her green card. The woman who interviewed her had hooves instead of feet, and somebody was changing the words in the book she was studying. Every day they were full of new lies, lies, lies. At first she had believed that she was being persecuted by jealous people, who hated her for her purity, but now she knew that God had become evil and begun purging the innocent. "The only hope I have is you," she wrote. "Could you come and take me from this pit of hell?" In the last few pages, she warned my father about me, reminded him of the Oedipus myth and of the fact that I lived in the United States, which meant that I was corrupt and untrustworthy. "Keep in mind," she wrote, "that God preferred sons to fathers and daughters." A different story. My father kept calling Nada, receiving no answer until her murderous roommate, Madrigal, picked up the phone and told my father that Nada had been institutionalized. He did not understand the word and could not pronounce it for me to translate, so I called Madrigal. "She just went nuts," Madrigal said. "In the library, she heard voices coming from the books, spreading rumors about her." my father was devastated. He called someone at the University of Nebraska and asked them in his Tarzan English to visit Nada at the institution and tell her that he had called. "We don't do that," the anonymous Nebraskan said. Father sat at his desk, frantically sharpening his pencil but not writing, until it was reduced to a stump he could barely hold between his fingers. He called every member of the family as if they could all pool their mental waves and send Nada a telepathic remedy. He called me almost every day, and then demanded that I call him back, as he could not afford the calls. He gave me reports of his futile attempts to reach Nada, and finally he asked me to go to Lincoln and track her down. I couldn't do it. "You've become American," he said. But that's a different story. The message. After the break, his story trickles away. He flies through an incident in which Ivan was stung by hundreds of bees and spent a few days in what must have been a coma. He devotes a paragraph to beekeeping in the 60s and 70s, which could be considered the second golden age of family beekeeping, even if father was going completely blind. When Ivan lost his sight, the bees slowly died off, and by the time he was dead, there were only 3 hives left. My father couldn't help. Traveling around the world, mainly in the Middle East and Africa, I could barely manage to see my parents 3 times a year, and there was no way I could devote any of my time to the bees. Shortly before his death, father summoned me and my brothers for a meeting of the family beekeeping tradition. His message... And there, The Bees Part 1 ends. No message delivered, though it isn't hard to imagine what it might have been. My grandfather died, my grandmother too, and my father and his brothers kept the bees. They, the bees, survived an epidemic of varroa mites, a drought, and the beginning of the war in Bosnia. When my family emigrated to Canada, they left behind 25 hives. Shortly after their departure, a horde of their neighbours, all drunken volunteers in the Serbian army, came at night, kicked the hives off their stands, and when the bees feebly tried to escape, once again it was a cold night and they crept on the ground, threw a couple of hand grenades, and laughed to see the dead bees flying around as if alive. They stole the heavy frames and left a trail of dripping honey in their wake. The Well. My father found a job in a factory, doing equipment maintenance. The factory was hot in the summer, cold in the winter, and when he worked night shifts he would sometimes fall asleep waiting for a green light at the wheel of a decrepit Lincoln town car. He hated the job, but he had no choice. One day, surveying the classifieds in search of a perfect garage sale, he found an ad for homemade honey. He called the number and told the man outright that he had no money to buy the honey, but that he would love to see his bees. Because there is such a thing as beekeeper's solidarity, the man invited him over. He was a Hungarian, a retired carpenter. He let my father help him with the bees and gave him old copies of Canadian Beekeeping, which my father tried to read with the insufficient help of my mother's dictionary. After a while, the Hungarian gave him a swarm and an old hive to start his own apiary. He admonished my father for refusing to wear overalls and a hat, or even gloves, but my father contended that stings were good for all kinds of pain. I still can't figure out what language they spoke to each other, but it almost certainly wasn't English. My father has 23 beehives now, and collects a few £100 of honey a year which he cannot sell. "Canadians don't appreciate honey," he says. "They don't understand it." He wants me to help him expand into the American market, but I assure him that Americans understand honey even less than Canadians. He recently decided to write another true book. It already has a title. The Well. There was a well near his home when he was a boy. Everybody went there to get water. Sometimes there were interesting incidents. Once, he remembers, a mule escaped and came to the well, sensing water there, but its head was tied to its leg, which was how people forced mules to graze then, and it was unable to drink. It lingered around the well, banging its head against the water trough, dying of thirst with water inches away. It brayed in horrible pain. It brayed all day, my father says. All day and all of the night.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.